Welcome to the Jacob's Well podcast. These messages are intended to feed you some great stuff that you can really dig your teeth into all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime, along with other great resources and ways to keep the conversation going at jacobs-well.net/leftovers. Enjoy the message.
Hey, good morning, Jacob's Well. Great to have you all here today. As we're winding into fall, which I guess is really going to feel like it's starting tomorrow, I'm Greg Meyer. It's good to be with you all today. So all that fun stuff out of the way, let's get down to real life, and let's watch this.
And officials now say the worst of the flooding in Houston is still 2 or 3 days away. Oh, no, the country's fourth largest city is already facing what could be one of the worst flooding disasters in American history.
Hundreds of streets and highways can only be navigated by boat. Thousands of people stranded in their homes have been rescued. Authorities have had trouble, though, identifying the hardest hit
areas. More than 80 large wildfires are burning in 10 western states. At least 9 firefighters have died. NewsHour special correspondent Kat Wise reports from the front lines of the nation's highest priority wildfire.
The Eagle Creek fire has charred some 30,000 acres in the heart of Oregon's scenic Columbia River Gorge. It isn't the biggest blaze crews are battling in the U.S., but today it's considered the most threatening to public safety and property.
But first, the USGS says a powerful 8.1 magnitude earthquake hit just off Mexico's southern coast overnight. Already at least 15 people are reported dead, and there is widespread damage.
Rubble from collapsed buildings in Chiapas littered the streets as rescue workers shoveled through the debris for survivors.
Manuel, first of all, are search and rescue missions still continuing on this day 4 since the quake struck, or is optimism fading?
So, yes, much of this will be recovery. They are very aware of the fact that if you have places like this one with 40 people still unaccounted for, they may be looking for bodies. But you have families, again, out here who are just imploring for these workers to continue what they would deem a search and rescue effort, hoping against hope, really, that somebody might still be alive in there.
The first pictures now coming in from Puerto Rico after taking a direct hit. Rhea is the first Category 4 to hit there in nearly a century. 150-mile-an-hour winds ripping buildings apart, knocking out power everywhere. All of the electricity is out tonight. People ordered to stay inside until at least tomorrow amid fears of more massive flooding to come.
And officials saying many areas will be uninhabitable for weeks, maybe even months. They're urging people to shelter in place. They've issued a curfew, and the governor now saying he is launching search and rescue teams as we speak.
Yeah, what do you say? That's only September, folks. Right? I'm not reaching in archives. That's all this month, and there are 6 days left yet, you know? And that's only North America. I mean, we kind of forgot about the famine and the war in South Sudan. Genocide in Myanmar is still going on. It's just like got pushed off the radar. It's got bumped by all of these things. I mean, you know, who knows what else is going on out there? Have you ever heard of the term compassion fatigue? That's it. That's it. And we're all experiencing it. We're all, hopefully at least, trying to deal with it. Well, we are dealing with it in one way or another. So we're talking humanize this month here with Jacob's Well. And we've had a proposition through these 3 weeks that says, and we developed it largely in week one, but that proposition is that compassion is the truest measure of humanity. Compassion is the truest measure of humanity. What that means is it isn't any physical characteristics like having 2 arms and 2 legs. It isn't our ability to use tools or languages or create complex societies. It is, you know, those might be characteristics of what we call homo sapiens, what we call human beings. But it's being fully and wholly human. This humanity is something else. And it has something to do with our capacity to care for one another, to identify with one another, to see each other as human beings for their own sake, not for our own. I think that is the core of humanity, that kind of compassion. In fact, you often hear it said, you know, when we question a person's humanity, what we're really doing is that we're saying that they failed to exhibit some basic compassion at a time when we would expect them to have done that. So I not only think that that's true, but I think that is why we are here. I think we have all acknowledged that there's something about this, you know, that primal story about the identity or the image of God being buried inside of us. I think that image of God has something to do with compassion being within us. I think God is fundamentally a God of compassion above and beyond anything else. And the identity, the image of God that is within us is this sense of compassion, of wholeheartedness, of being with and for other people for their sake and being joined together in that way. And I think that's why we're here, because I think all of us know is, you know, while success and fame and glory all have their places and their roles in our lives and in our world, we know that those aren't the places that we're really going to find the meaning. We're not going to find the fulfillment. We're not going to find what we're looking for in life. And it is someplace deeper inside of us. It's in something that we give away and not that we have or that we accumulate. But this 24/7 news cycle that we live with that lets us know way too much, how do we deal with that? I mean, it's hard to escape it. I mean, it's right in front of your eyeballs. It's delivered to your pocket, right to your hand. You don't have to go anywhere. It comes to you. And that's so overwhelming. It really begs that question. How do you, and this is on your outlines if you follow along in that outline, but how do you love your neighbor when you've got 7 billion neighbors? How do you love your neighbor as yourself when there are 7 billion of them in this planet? That's tough. Or as the title of this message puts it, how do you put out a fire with an eyedropper? You know, especially a forest fire. How are you going to do that with an eyedropper? It seems impossible. You know, we really want to give up. So the reality, at least the way we see it, is this. The world's needs are too many. They're just more there than we can even know about. And they're too far away. So many of them they're distant. I can't go there. I can't be there. I can't just go touch something and be something. And they're also too demanding. They ask too much of us. The need is so great. What could I possibly do in the face of a world with the kind of hurt, the kind of pain, the kind of problems that we have? And that's all too true, which may explain why we as individuals, I would say, have a tendency, an instinct for compassion. I mean, whose heart doesn't go out when they see the crying child? Or, you know, when a friend is really in need that you're close to, I mean, who isn't just moved to do something about it? But while that tends to be true about us sometimes as individuals, as a society, we seem to be very not compassionate. There are so many problems, so many hurts, so many unnecessary things going on in our world that we collectively don't seem to care enough to actually do something about, even though we could solve the problems if we tried to. Compassion is hard for us, especially on this big scale. So one response that we have, and this is familiar to you, don't need me to tell you, so you're going to recognize this. But one response is to find ways that we can control or limit our compassion because we don't want to be overwhelmed by it. And we do it, lots of ways, but I'm going to sum it up into three ways. We do it, first of all, by numbing our reactions. I numb my reaction to find ways to reduce my emotional reaction to the things that are going on around me. I might do it with a callousness. You know, another famine. You just kind of find a way to brush it off. You just emotionally stay away from it. You might do it with humor, deflect it with, you know, I don't know. I watched that montage of videos of all these disasters, and one of my first reactions is to make a joke about it. And I realized I can't do that, but I'm trying to emotionally numb myself from it, from the reality of it. We even do it chemically. I mean, and we do it with our business. I mean, how common it is for us to just be really busy with work so that our mind is there all the time. We got good blinders on. We don't see the big, bad world. I'm busy doing my important thing, and I go home, and I have a couple drinks, and so that I, you know, nothing else really touches me. But one thing is that we numb ourselves. Another thing is that we detach from awareness. We find ways to reduce our exposure to information. We just stop watching the news. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to read the paper. It's a downer. I change the subject in my mind when it comes up, and I think about other things. I avoid connections with people or with organizations that either are the people that are being affected by things like this, or that maybe kind of are trying to deal with it and bringing it to mind for me, because, you know, I'm just gonna stick to fun stuff. So I detach from awareness. The other thing is that we dismiss the need. We find ways to reduce our responsibility. I reduce my responsibility by placing blame or responsibility on the people who are suffering themselves, or at least the people that are close to them. It's not my fault. I mean, I would have told them not to build their houses in a floodplain. You know, they knew that where they lived has a threat of earthquakes and hurricanes. I mean, that's a risk they took. It's too bad, but it's a risk they took. Or maybe we, you know, put it on the fault of some defects in the people themselves. I mean, he's always been impetuous. He should have known sooner or later this was going to happen to him. Or, like, what didn't she know about smoking? I mean, had she never heard of lung cancer? I mean, come on. Now, the thing about those reactions, about that reaction, is that you might be absolutely right. I mean, it maybe is their fault. But here's the thing. Compassion isn't about fault. Compassion isn't about justice. Compassion is about love. Compassion is about loving another person the way that you would want to be loved. It's about recognizing our shared humanity. It's about seeing our connectedness through a God who loves all people the same, no matter what, whether you deserve it or whether you don't. And here's the problem with all of those techniques and the others that you could probably list along with it, is that all of them, what they're doing is dehumanizing other people. How can I make these people objects so that I don't have to actually feel their pain? I don't actually have to be there with it. And here's the truth, folks. You cannot dehumanize another person without dehumanizing yourself. It is the only way to do it. It is a downward cycle of dehumanization that we begin. And the cost, that is the cost of numbing or of detaching or dismissing. It is to reduce your own humanity itself. And besides that, it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't. First of all, it doesn't bring relief to anybody else, so it doesn't help any of the problems in the world. It just is a way of keeping yourself out of it. And it falls victim to a fundamental error of understanding how the world works. It falls victim to this myth that it's all about me. That it's me who has to fix a problem, and that's too much, and so I'm not going to do it. We've talked a lot about that question of what can I do? The big problem word there is I. What can I do? Well, it isn't all about you. I mean, it isn't all up to you. If it was all up to you, yes, it would be hopeless. Yes, there would be no way to go about it. But it isn't just you. This leads us, this kind of thinking, this what can I do, leads us into the fixing mode that we use to protect ourselves from the discomfort that we see in other people and their suffering and in their need and their hurt, or maybe our own need and hurt and suffering that theirs reminds us of and we don't want to know about. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to talk about it. And in cases like this, it ends up paralyzing us as well. What can I do? Not much. Remember, the world's problems are too many and too far away and too demanding. I can't do anything about it. The third thing is, those techniques don't really even protect you, let alone help anything. I mean, you can't hide forever. Inside, we know the truth. When, even though we didn't want to, we get a glimpse of the eyes of that person that we want to put the blame on, and we realize they are a real person, or we see shadows of them in our own lives, or maybe in our children, and something in us starts to waken up. We can ignore the news, but we can't live in a vacuum forever. And sooner or later, the tide turns, and you discover your own suffering, and your need to be seen and to be loved for who you really are wakes up. And you realize that's the only way to be a human being. So, that's the path down. You guys are familiar with Menti by now, at least many of you are. If you aren't, I want to engage you in creating a word cloud around the things that we are concerned about. All right? You're going to see it up here on the screen. So, this is what you do. This isn't an app. You don't have to download anything. Your phone or whatever, your email isn't accessible to anything. But if you go to Menti, M-E-N-T-I, so at the very top of the screen, menti.com, and it's going to ask you for a code, and you put in 128848. Oh, there, we got someone in there already. Giving us a little love. All right, so pop into the next screen, and you're going to see this come up on your phone as you come in. What problems concern you right now? Think big. So here's how this works. You're creating a word cloud. So just one, you can only submit one thing at a time, but you can submit as many times as you want. And you don't put a whole sentence in, because it's like how many times people repeat something. So what I think is works the best, put in one thing that you're thinking of, and then see what other people are putting up, and then you can add your own new thoughts, or you can repeat things that you see up there, and then we start seeing like what's the accumulation? What's the common factors behind it all? So take a minute and start seeing what's going on there. So you start seeing, for those listening on the podcast, we will post this along with the podcast link so you can see what people are doing, but it's getting pretty big. There's one big word in the middle that... what does that say? So, a lot of people are concerned about the direction of our presidency, about Donald Trump, hate, work, climate change, health. So that's going to go off the screen, but that doesn't mean you can't keep contributing to it, okay? In fact, until another question comes up, you're always welcome to put something up there. You just won't see it till we're all done or till you download it later. So that's one big thing, okay? The kids are, they're doing something called Ubuntu, which is really talking about this humanizing thing the same, in a lot of the same ways that we are. And one of the things that they're learning today is South African greeting that people use. And the one person says to the other, Sobona, which means, I see you. Which I think is what humanity is about. It's actually seeing another person. And the response then is, Sikona. I am here. Sobona, I see you. Sikona, I am here. What a great way for us to be people. So if you've got kids that are in the kids' programs here today with Spatula or H2O or the lounge and so on, River Rats, that might be something you want to connect with them. Have them teach you those words, all right, as a great way to understand how we view one another. Okay, so that's one way of how we do a lot of this stuff. But there is another way of how we can see one another, and that's the good news. There's a way that doesn't cycle down into dehumanity and ignores suffering, but there's one that cycles up humanity and actually seeks to be with one another in our suffering and in our pain and in our hurt, even though it can't always relieve it and take it away, and that's just the way it is. The bad news about this other way is it's harder, okay? But you all know that already, right? You know that it's a harder way. And so I want to dive into that. And it's really all premised from something I said earlier, and that God is fundamentally a God of compassion. For me, that's where this whole response comes from and where it grows out of, is this God of compassion. In fact, in the New Testament of the Bible, the part of the Bible that was written after the time of Jesus, there's this just three-word statement that is there that says, God is love, period. God is love. We think about all kinds of things. There's all kinds of other stuff that's written about God, but cut to the chase, if you really want to know about God and you want to make sure everything else you understand about God is right, remember that God is love. It is not God is love asterisk like this, you know, with the legal disclosure of limited liability and responsibility like on everything you get in this world, right? Yeah, this is an unlimited guarantee except for these three pages of fine print. God does not come with that. It is just plain God is love. No asterisk, no parenthetical statements, God is love. And that's really propels us on this other way, and I think gives us the power to believe that way. So what does it look like? I want to talk about it two ways. I want to just talk about a few descriptors, then I want to look at something from the life of Jesus that helps us see how it's put into work. And so the first thing is that we stay aware of needs. You can never know everything. You can never know everything about everything, so that you can always do the right thing and be the right person in the right place, but you can know something. And at least you can know enough to know when it is your time to be there for someone else and when it's time for you to play your role. Knowledge may feel overwhelming, but knowledge is also power. So stay aware of needs in the world around you. The next is be vulnerable to your compassion. Be vulnerable to your compassion. Don't hide from the pain and the discomfort of what you see in the world. Let it into your heart. That's life you're feeling. That pain is your humanity, like a little sprout pushing its way through the soil so that it can find the light and grow and bear fruit. It's a painful process, but it's real life, so go for that. And you remember, we cannot selectively numb, right? That's one of the things we do. When we decide not to be vulnerable and we numb ourselves to the world, we numb ourselves from everything, not just from the pain, we also numb ourselves from the joy, from the stuff that we want to be a part of. And the same thing, you can't filter out only the bad news, only the tough stuff. When you filter out all the tough stuff, your filters are going to be there and you're going to miss the good stuff as well. See, humanity isn't always nice and convenient or pleasant. Humanity is so amazing because it's the beauty of it can be found both because of and despite all this tough stuff that we experience because we live within our humanity. So be vulnerable to your compassion. Another is set priorities and make choices. All right? Yes, you are only one person. You can't and aren't expected to do it all. You're going to have to make choices. And sometimes that's going to look and feel kind of cold-hearted. But seeing as though you have finite time, energy, and resources, you're going to have to decide how you're going to use them. I mean, it doesn't make sense to be with one friend who is going through cancer, or to be working really hard to help people in Houston after Hurricane Harvey, only to completely abandon them and switch to another person because they are now dealing with divorce or because now Hurricane Irma has hit Florida, all right? Somehow we have to deal with some of this sort of stuff and figure out how we can do it together. But along with making these choices then, we have to realize that we have to continue to, and this is the next one, rethink our decisions. It's way too convenient to say, well, I really struggled about this and I decided how I was going to approach these kind of problems or those kind of people. I'm sorry, people and problems are not categorical, they are individual. Humanity sees people through their eyes, the eyes of individuals, not through the categories that they represent. So, yes, make decisions about how you are going to be compassionate in the world, but when you are confronted with new situations, stop and reevaluate. Rethink your decisions. That's important. It's inconvenient. I'm sorry. Humanity is often a little bit inconvenient. So if you want to be one of those human being type things, you're going to have to live with that. It's messy. Finally, remember you are not the hero, but you do have a role. It isn't what should I do, because it all depends on me and my being able to come to the rescue and save the day, but what is my role? Sometimes the answer is nothing. Sometimes the answer is to connect them with other people. Sometimes it's to reach out for them. Sometimes it is just to remember them. Sometimes it is to be in there and slog through it with them. That's something that we've talked a lot about in Care IQ. Being a hero assumes that it is what you alone can do. Having a role acknowledges that you are only one part of a huge and a complicated puzzle. And you probably can't even see it all. You don't know it all. So when you feel overwhelmed, take a careful and a generous appraisal of what your role could be. And then remember the millions of others who can be asking and hopefully are asking that same question about what they can do. Remember, the impossible happens when many people focus on what is possible. Let me repeat that. The impossible happens not when you do the impossible, but when many people focus on what is possible, what their roles are. We can do that. We can have hope. So a couple weeks ago, I talked about compassion being the best lens through which, when we look at Jesus and understand who he was and what he was about. We tend to put all kinds of other things on Jesus, kind of like we do on God. But I would really argue for compassion being the best descriptor. He was not the rule maker. He was not the bringer of requirements. He is not the gatekeeper. He isn't the perfect model of a life, and we're supposed to do it exactly like he did it. Rather, he was a real-life embodiment of God's desire to love us in all of its messy, no way to perfectly do it for all people at all times in all situations, but to live with that and to do that. So we don't discover any secret formulas when we look at the life of Jesus, but we do see some rhythms there. We see ways of how he embodied God's love in order to find ways that he could follow it and let his heart be there with it. And as we do that, I think we understand a little bit how it can work for ourselves as way, for ourselves as well. And I think we see when we look at Jesus that way, why he has never been forgotten by this world, and why I would argue he's probably changed the world forever. So, and I talked about this same story from Jesus' life a couple months ago at the Falls. I talked about his feeding of the 4,000, and I really focused on all the baskets of food that were left over and kind of what the meaning was about that. Really arguing, and I'll say the same thing today, these stories are not meant to be examples of God's power. Ooh, look what God can do. Look what Jesus can do. He can make all his food come out of nothing or out of nowhere. I mean, that's not what was happening at all. These are not shock and awe stories. What God is trying to teach us, what Jesus was trying to show us, is something about how our world really works that we can actually be engaged with, that is a pattern of how we can live as well today. So I want to look at a story from two chapters before. That was the feeding of the 4,000. I want to look at the feeding of the 5,000 today. 5,000 men, they didn't count women and children. It was probably like 10, 15. I know. So let me take you into the story. First of all, a little background on it. Jesus and the disciples are overwhelmed. They're overwhelmed with the needs for compassion in the world around them. They'd had tough stuff happening, and so they all decide, we need a break. We need a little alone time. We're going to find a place where we can be away from the crowds for a little bit. Well, it doesn't work. Word travels fast, and as soon as they get to where they're going to be alone, the people start showing up by the thousands. And the story tells us that Jesus, and it uses this classic word for compassion. It says Jesus was moved by compassion. It's the word splachnachthin. It's the word for your intestines. He felt it in his guts. He had no choice but to do what a human being would do. He responded to their need. He went to them. He taught them. He did all of the Jesus kind of things that he does with people. All right? And it's getting on. And I think his disciples are trying to keep up with Jesus and be there with him. And here's where we plop into a story, and we're going to see it on this isn't on your Sunday papers yet, but it is on the screen. The story tells us it was late in the day, so Jesus' disciples come to him, pull on his coat. This is a remote place. We're out in the boonies, and it's really late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. And Jesus looks at them, and he says, you guys give them something to eat. And they say to him, that would take 8 months of a man's wages. Basically, that would be a small fortune, Jesus. Are we to go and spend all that money on bread and give it to them to eat? Basically, he's saying to them, get real, Jesus. I mean, this isn't going to happen, right? So Jesus, I don't know if he rolled his eyes or just took a big sigh, and he looks at his followers, his disciples, and he says, how many loaves do you have? How much food do you got? All right? And does this mean you, the disciples, but like among us? What do you have? And they're kind of looking at each other like, where is this going? And Jesus says, go and see. So they go and they take inventory. They come back and they say, well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus, here's where I really want to buckle down on this. This is what Jesus does. He takes the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. Looking up to heaven, Jesus gave thanks and broke the loaves. And then he gave them to his disciples to set before the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 baskets of broken pieces of bread and fish. Now, there's something going on in here that's maybe easy to miss, but I think it teaches us an awful lot about this rhythm of life that can somehow be compassionate in a world that is overwhelming for us. Here's what I see going on here. First of all, Jesus gathers his resources. All right? He said, what do we have? What's out there? I know I can't just do it myself, so let's gather our resources. You see when he says, how many loaves do we have? Go and see. And then he takes the five loaves and the two fish. He gathers his resources. Jesus knew it wasn't all about him. He didn't have enough food to give away. In fact, I happen to know he did not even have pockets in his toga. Okay? So there is no way he could feed all these people. All right? If this impossibility was going to be possible, it was going to be because they all did what was possible. So he gathered what was available. Not much, but it's a start. And then he looks beyond. He looks beyond. What the story says is that he looked up. He wasn't looking up because he knew God was up there. What he was doing is he was looking beyond. He wasn't just looking to himself and what he could do. He wasn't just looking to his disciples and what they could do. I mean, those are the first two strands, right, of the rope. Myself, what I bring to the table, and the people around me, what do they bring to the people? But he knew that we need to be woven into something even bigger than that as well, a third strand, God. And he wasn't God calling on God to pull off a miracle here. He was looking beyond himself in order to get a glimpse of an economy that happens, an economy that is more deeply woven into the fabric of our existence than we can ever see, and that we have trouble having faith and believing in. But that happens when we believe in each other and we hold hope together. Things happen that we didn't think were possible. Jesus looked beyond the limits of what was in front of him, and he looked up. He looked deep into the fabric of existence to see what could happen as they gathered together. The next thing he did is he was grateful. Be grateful. He gave thanks. Yeah, why not? I mean, we focus on what we don't have and what we can't do. Gratitude focuses on what we do have and what we can do. And that's a fundamental difference, especially when you realize you are part of the puzzle, not the whole thing. You are not the hero, but you have a role. What is it that you have? That is something, even if it doesn't seem like much. Put it in the hands of all the other people who have a role in the economy of a God that says life is always about more life. And that says impossibility is really just a function of limitations that we accept, not a true measure of what is actually possible in the world around us. When we do that, whatever you've got is good, and it is worth giving thanks for. Then, be broken open. He took the bread, and he broke it. Now, this could be, and probably someday will be, a message all by itself, but let me take a crack at it. Let me break it open for you just a little bit. When Jesus took the bread, and he broke it, he was not trying to put it into smaller pieces so it'd be more manageable for people. All right? What he broke open was the bread. He broke open was himself. What he broke open was you. What he broke open was me. Jesus was telling something about how compassion finds its way into our hearts. The loaves were him, and they were you, and they were me. We are broken open. We are not torn apart. We are not broken down. We are broken open. So that something that we probably protected ourselves from all of our lives could seep into our hearts and transform us. We need to be broken open. I mean, that's something to stop and think about right now. What is it in your life that you have spent so much time and so much energy protecting even yourself from so that you wouldn't have to know it? That needs to be broken open so that love can be in there. It is only people with broken hearts that can truly love, and it's only people with broken hearts that know how to be truly loved. Being broken open. We said it before, be vulnerable to your compassion. It is your path to humanity. Last, rely on others. It says Jesus gave the loaves, gave the fish to his disciples. I think you got this, right? You are not the hero, but you do have a role, all right? You can't do this alone. Dealing with the overwhelming needs of a world that needs dealing with the overwhelming needs of a world that needs a lot more love, a lot more generosity, a lot more acceptance is not going to be accomplished by a couple of Bill and Melinda Gates, all right? It's not going to be accomplished by a couple of well-meaning, powerful nations. It's going to happen when all of us become dispensers of the gifts that God has given each and every one of us. That is when things will change. Jesus didn't hand out the bread and the fish. He took it. He looked up. He gave thanks. He broke it. And he gave it to others so that they could each play their role and they could put it to work. So, the crises of this world that we all face, they are overwhelming. I don't know, that's my reaction. I mean, I always feel that way to a certain extent. This month has blown me away. There's too many of them. They are too far away that I can't really feel like I can do anything about it, and they're too demanding. But is that going to be the last word? Are we going to give up? Well, we can hide from it, we can make excuses, we can let our hearts be broken time and time again. And every time we do it, I think we'll find that we're made stronger and we're made more whole. And we are made better vehicles of this love of God that is what our lives are really all about. There's going to be another mentee question up here now. Taff, can you bring that up? Pop to the next, hit space bar and bring up the next menu. There you go. What can you do to express your compassion? And so that is going to be up there, and you can add to it as we go here. And gradually, the slide will move on to the song, probably. But it is still live, and you can keep putting stuff up there, okay? Go. So let this also be our prayer.
Thanks for listening. If you found this podcast valuable, please pass it along to others. And we'd love to hear from you, too. You can email us at info@jacobs-well.net or message Jacobs Well Minneapolis on Facebook. We see what we do as a community really making a difference for people. Since you're listening, you probably have, too. If you'd like to make a donation to support this work, you can find ways at jacobs-well.net/give. Thanks. Listen again next week or join us in person Sunday mornings at 10:30.